from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If it feels like auto recalls are in the news a lot these days, you're not wrong. 2014 and 2015 were record years for recalls. Big, deadly problems like the deadly Takata airbags that blast shrapnel, runaway Jeeps, software glitches that can seem minor, but they can hurt you too. Recalls are now a regular part of doing business for automakers, but they're not working as well as you might think. This hour on Point, the business of recalls and the risks to Americans on the roads. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you been getting recall notices? Are you acting on them or trying to, or just driving that time bomb? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We want to look at airport security in this hour as well. As we go to air, there are reports of an active shooter at Joint Base Andrews Air Force Base in Washington. That, of course, is the home of where the president flies out, among many other things. And all of our air security reporters are suddenly rushing to that story. We'll try and come back to airport security. I want to turn to the story of the rise in auto recalls. Joining me first today from Detroit is Mike Spector, automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Mike, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
We've got these huge numbers. Is it all about Takata, or what's driving this record recall numbers in 14 and 15, Mike?
Well, you're right. Takata is driving this to a large extent. You mentioned it at the top of the show. There's nearly 70 million airbags being recalled in the U.S. alone, and that doesn't even take into account far more across the rest of the globe.
That's an unbelievable number.
It's a earth-shattering number. It's unprecedented, and it's extraordinarily complex. You have situations where people have to take in vehicles to get their airbags replaced with, you used the term time bomb, with other ticking time bombs, with other airbags that have these controversial ammonium nitrate inflators that can degrade and then explode, and then they have to take them to get fixed again. And the reason for that is officials would rather have you come in and get that old airbag replaced with a new one that's less risky rather than driving around the old time bomb.
Can we just stick with the airbags for a minute? Because, you know, they seem to me, anyway, the most immediately frightening of these. I've got a Honda CR-V, that little kind of Honda SUV. It is
sure.
On that list. I got the recall notice. It took me a while to get around to it. I wasn't driving it much. I called in just a couple of weeks ago and said, hey, I'm ready to get this airbag replaced. And they said that could be 30 or 40 days or much longer. We don't know.
Right. They said, sorry, we don't have parts, right?
Yeah.
But
I mean, I feel like driving that is a real risk to life and limb and face.
Yeah, so I mean, it's the headline risk to this is frightening, because what can happen with these airbags when they're exposed to high heat and humidity, and if they're older, a number of years old, the propellant that causes the airbag to fire can degrade, and then the ammonium nitrate that causes that explosion that's supposed to just make your airbag fire when you get in a crash.
Yep.
If you're in a minor crash, it can cause that to just destabilize, and then the thing fires and shrapnel goes flying out of the airbag, and it's killed at least 11 people. There are some reports of other deaths that may end up getting linked to this as well. And you know, these are deaths where, you know, shrapnel hits you in the neck and you bleed. However, it's worth pointing out that...
Tell me something good.
Yeah, the risk with these things varies depending on, if we're just talking about the United States, you know, where you live and how old your airbag is. And so the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, that's the federal government agency that's in charge of monitoring the auto industry and monitoring recalls, has this whole global coordinated, extraordinarily complicated process going on across the industry for these Takata airbag recalls. And it's prioritized based on regions of the country and, as I said, how old the airbag is. So, for example, a car that's 10 years old with a Takata airbag in Florida is going to be at the top of that list. A car that's 3 years old in Boston is going to be at the bottom of that list because that's a far less risky situation, far less likelihood of something going wrong with that airbag.
I tell you, that's exactly how they tried to calm my nerves when I called in about my own Honda. They say, well, you know, that's really about older cars in hot, steamy parts of the country. But when you hear what has happened to people when this goes wrong, it's just terrible. And this was Stephanie Erdman, hit by shrapnel in her face with a Takata airbag in her Honda Civic, exploded in a collision. She talked to CBS News last year about the price she paid.
Instant blindness on my right side, followed by gushing blood. It was terrifying. Yeah, I thought I was going to bleed out at first.
And that's just airbags. Mike Spector with the Wall Street Journal. Okay, airbags. Let's set them to the side for a moment. What else is driving these huge recall numbers in 2014 and 2015?
Well, when you look at the real driver, aside from Takata, which is really a disproportionate amount of this, you have to look at the General Motors ignition switch recall. This was a catastrophic safety situation that's, using some liberal methodology, granted, is now linked to 124 deaths. And the problem with this ignition switch, as has been widely reported by us and others, is it can slip out of the run position if you just bang it with your knee or there's, you know, some heavy vibration. Okay. And that can cut power to power steering, power brakes, your airbags. The main issue is that thing slips into the sort of no man's land between off and on. They call it accessory.
I don't even know what that means exactly. Okay, right. I guess I've seen that. Okay, but well, I don't know what it means, but I've seen
it. Yeah, no, it's a, we'll call it no man's land for
just
for
run the radio or something while you're waiting.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But, you know, we've all been there. It's sort of, you know, you turn your key and maybe your radio works, but your engine hasn't started, right?
Yep.
So your car's on and then the ignition gets knocked and it's not supposed to be able to just slip into that accessory position, but these could because of a manufacturing problem. And then you could crash, you know, if you got in a crash, your airbag would not go off. And there were 124 deaths linked to this. And GM, people inside GM knew about this for more than a decade. And there were lawsuits and legal settlements. And they didn't do anything about this. And so finally, when it got kicked up the chain to the CEO and other senior executives, they launched a big recall in early 2014. And then all of a sudden, they were on the hot seat on Capitol Hill before both the House and the Senate. And so that increased scrutiny of the auto industry. That recall itself was such a high-profile calamity that there was suddenly pressure on NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, to do more to better police automakers. And you had a new leader of that agency come in toward the end of that year. And so then going forward, you just saw, I mean, GM voluntarily, just to be better safe than sorry, recalled a record number of vehicles all on its own in 2014 in the wake of that ignition switch scandal. And then government officials were all over other automakers to pressure them into doing other recalls. So you've now seen just an unprecedented amount of activity.
We all remember when that first came to light. Amber Rose died at 16. This is 2004. Crashed her Chevy Cobalt. It switched off while she was driving, and her airbag failed. She crashed into a tree. Known person to die from that faulty ignition. This was her mother, Laura Christian, saying GM put profits before, birth mother saying profits before safety.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. We are the people left behind when a loved one got into what was supposed to be a safe car, a GM car, a car that GM knew for years was dangerous and defective. Our daughters, sons, sisters, brothers, mothers, fathers, wives, and husbands are gone because they were a cost of doing business, GM's style.
And then we saw just in the last few days, the Star Trek actor, Anton Yelchin, he was killed when his 2015 Jeep Grand Cherokee, it rolled backward in his steep driveway in L.A., pinned him against a brick wall and a fence. He died. Now, it's not known exactly whether this was due to a specific recall defect, but There's a defect around exactly this roll-away problem with the Grand Cherokee, Mike.
Sure. And so investigators, as you mentioned, are still investigating the circumstances around that death. But you're absolutely correct. And this was a situation, actually, where, you know, in the GM case, as we were just discussing, you know, there was no intentional cover-up found, but there was this prolonged period of people inside the company knowing about this thing and not alerting regulators. That resulted in criminal charges that the company had to settle. So that was a big deal. Here with this Jeep, Fiat Chrysler, part of this new recall environment, getting much more proactive, and they are a company that has really been under a lot of scrutiny, more than some others. They actually, a couple of months ago, two, 3 months ago, recalled these vehicles for this gear shift issue. It's kind of a new design that's been popping up where the gear shift will be in the center and you might move it up to park and then it ratchets back to where it was. So we're all often used to these gear shifts where you shift it up to park and it stays there. And every time you go down to reverse or drive or what have you, it goes where you put it. This one has like little lights on the top of the knob that shows you whether it's in park, reverse, or drive. But after you move it to that position, it just springs back to where it was. And the company determined that they had some reports where people were getting confused and there weren't enough alerts in the car to tell them that if they were leaving their car, that maybe they didn't realize that the car wasn't in park because of this kind of new system with the gear shift. So it hasn't officially been linked to the Star Trek actor's death, but it's almost certainly the cause. He almost certainly got out of his Jeep and didn't realize that it wasn't in park and then, you know, likely walked behind it, and then the thing rolled away and killed him.
Nobody wants their Jeep Grand Cherokee. That's a big hunk of metal chasing them down the driveway.
Yeah, yeah, and a very popular hunk of metal. Selling like hotcakes.
Yeah,
so.
But it seems to me that a lot of people are not exactly responding instantly to these recall notices, that we've got a lot of cars with recall notices out on them on the highways.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big problem that you're highlighting, and it's because of an antiquated recall system that deals with paper mail, and the laws on the books require automakers to notify consumers within 60 days of finding a safety defect. That allows for them to ramp up parts production because there are often parts shortages that maybe we'll discuss more in a bit. But it's an antiquated system, and frankly, 20-25% of consumers just don't even respond to recalls. 80% or so with a newer car will. When those cars get really old, that response rate can drop all the way down to 15%.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this about this auto recall moment, too. Record years for recalls back-to-back and the fallout for you and for the industry. Mike Spector is with us, automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal. You can join us as well. Have you had recall notices drifting into your mailbox, your inbox, like snow? Does it feel like you hear about a big new one every week? And are you driving around scared to death of your own Takata airbag? Is your dealer telling you you just have to wait for a replacement? He doesn't have the parts. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And it's not just airbags. Victor Yelchin, 27-year-old, the actor who played Chekhov in the 2009 and 2013 remakes of Star Trek, died earlier this month when his Jeep Grand Cherokee rolled back on him in his own driveway in L.A. The Jeep was part of a recall in April to fix a problem with its electronic gear shift. Here's a moment from the 2009 Star Trek movie where he's first introduced to Captain Pike.
Russian whiz kid, what's your name, Chanko? Chirpov?
Ensign Chekhov, Pavel Andreevich, sir.
Fine. Chekhov, Pavel Andreevich. Begin shipwide mission broadcast.
Yes, sir. Happy to. Ensign authorization code 95, Victor, Victor 2.
Access granted.
That's Anton Yelchin from the Star Trek movie. He's dead. He's dead. That big old Jeep rolled back on him. Of course, Volkswagen is all over this story as well. 2016 Volkswagen Passat at the launch in Brooklyn last September. American President CEO of Volkswagen Michael Horn talked about the emissions scandal and offered his own apology. We all heard about that, how they lied about what the emissions were on the diesel cars there.
So let's be clear about this. Our company was dishonest with the EPA and the California Air Resources Board and with all of you. And in my German words, we have totally screwed up. We must fix those cars. Thank you. We must fix those cars, the cars we prevent this from ever happening again, and we have to make things right with the government, the public, our customers, our employees, and also, very important, our dealers.
The whole Volkswagen diesel mess right there. Mike Spector, please stand by in Detroit. Right now from Providence, Rhode Island, Sean Kane joins us as well. Founder, president of Safety Research and Strategies, is a for-profit, does research and consulting on motor vehicle safety, pro bono work on consumer issues. Sean Kane, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for asking me to come.
You started your career working for Ralph Nader's Center for Auto Safety. What do you make of this surge in recalls? Is quality up or down here, or are we just handling glitches in a different way? What's going on?
I think you can answer yes to all of that, and this is a complex situation. I think if you really boil it down, what we've got is a confluence of a lot of factors. First of all, you know, you've got an antiquated recall system, as Mike Spector noted out. It's really something we need to update for the 21st century. Second, I would say that, you know, one of the key issues that's playing a role here is lack of up-to-date regulations. The fact that the regulations have not kept up with the technology in the vehicles means that the standards that should be in place to govern these sophisticated systems that are running our cars today are not in place. Thus, they don't get handled on the front end. They get handled in what's called the enforcement side, the recall side. I'd also say the other things that we're seeing is the increase of those electronics. I mean, our cars are turning very rapidly from mechanical systems to electronics. And again, because they're largely unregulated, we're seeing these systems come up with a lot of bugs, and those are contributing to some significant numbers in recalls. Throw in the globalization and the components and assemblies today, and you know, when you have recalls, you can have massive recalls. That throws a big piece into it. And when you look at the government regulators, the lack of enforcement that's been going on for years has piled up. So what we're seeing is this: all of a sudden, we got a new cop on the beat. We've Administrator Rosekind, who's really stepped things up at the agency.
It's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Is he the guy there?
That's right. He's heading the NHTSA, what we call NHTSA.
NHTSA.
And you know, at the end of the day, I mean, there's still unpiling problems. And this, for example, the Takata crisis could have been averted many, many years ago. That's a problem where the manufacturers and, frankly, NHTSA played a role in kicking the can down the line to create the crisis we see today.
Boy, it's a huge-scale crisis. I mean, software you talk about, and I'm reading here people talking about new vehicles that can contain more than 10 times as much code in an automobile as in an F-35 Joint Strike Fighter jet. That's pretty amazing. Software-related vehicle recalls up to 15% now, up from 5% in 2011. But that leaves many, many other kinds. We've got so many questions for you. We want to hear the stories from our listeners, whether or not they're even taking their cars in to get these issues addressed. If it's that airbag, you want to take that in. But when you do, when you can get it fixed, is a big issue in itself. Let's get some calls. Mary D., hang on. Jim in Mount Vernon, Kentucky. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, I used to work in manufacturing. I worked in quality, and the field I was involved with was electronics, circuit board manufacturing, okay, and so forth.
Yep.
And one of the things that I observed was each year, you know, a lot of your customers would come back to you and say, hey, we need you to give us some cost savings. We need you to bring down the cost.
Customers like the dealerships, you mean, saying, give us cheaper cars to sell.
I'm not talking about the dealerships. I'm talking about the major suppliers,
yep,
that supply parts to the manufacturers.
Okay.
And you can only cut so much before you start to degrade the quality of the product. And I have seen where, you know, we may have been encouraged to say, use a different transistor or use a different tiny part. It might be just a few cents. But there is just a tremendous force driving, trying to keep costs down. And the GM switch, the ignition switch,
issue,
I think, is
a
classic example.
Jim, I'm glad you raised exactly that. And Sean, jump in here with us.
Sure.
What about cost-cutting pressures? Is that what we're talking about here? People trying to save half a cent on the thing and suddenly it's just not as safe?
Well, you know, I think he's absolutely right, and that's playing a significant role. We look at something like the Takata airbag. You know, they used what's called a phase-stabilized ammonium nitrate as a propellant. that propellant, nobody's been using it because phase stabilizing, it's the holy grail. It's a very inexpensive, you know, it's fertilizer. It's what Tim McVeigh used to blow up the federal
building. Yeah, I used to use it as a blasting guy years ago. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. So, you know, it's inexpensive, but it creates some other problems that really create some issues in context of not just the difficulty in manufacturing, but it isn't as stable and it can ramp up and create this overpressurization issue. Now, why would Honda drive this towards, with their major supplier, Takata? Well, clearly cost was a role. And, you know, I think the backstory in all of this is, you know, here's Honda, which was their primary, the primary client for Takata,
yep,
putting these airbags in. They're known as being a very, very quality oriented company. There's their management of their suppliers is literally, you know, legendary.
So why do this? I mean, people have got their faces blown off.
Exactly. I mean, so that's the great question is how could they possibly have blown through their own red lights for so long if not but for the cost factor? There's no other explanation. This is something that, you know, it was significantly cheaper and Honda was likely pushing down that cost and pushing this safety problem down the road.
We've got more callers here. Mary in Destin, Florida. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see? What do you know?
I kept getting recall notices in the mail and actually phone calls. And I finally called one of the numbers.
What do you drive, Mary? What are you driving these days?
I drive an 04 Toyota Sequoia.
Oh, that's a big hunk of metal. Okay. And you got recall notices. How'd it go?
That was about February, and they allegedly set up an appointment for me, and the dealership would call me back, and I have yet to hear from anybody. So I'm wondering if it's a scam.
Scams around recalls. Let us ask. Mike Spector, have you heard of scams related to recalls?
You don't really hear too much about scams, per se, but what she's hitting on is a critical issue that I mentioned earlier and Sean reiterated in terms of this antiquated recall system. I mean, you hear tragic cases. We've done reporting where there were these old Jeeps with rear gas tanks that were recalled because they risked rupturing and blowing up, catching on fire and exploding when they got rear-ended.
Not good.
And you'd have people who would perish in these crashes, in these fiery crashes, and then their loved ones would find a recall notice in their mail or their belongings that arrived a week before the accident, or sometimes they come a week after the accident. That you hear often about that with the Takata recall, with Takata fatalities, with recall notices coming later. And, you know, you have a situation where these recall notices get sent to the last registered owner. So when used cars get transferred, mm-hmm, and titles get transferred, sometimes people don't catch up with these things. And then, you know, the parts shortages, it's a real difficult situation where automakers will launch a recall and then they have to ramp up the parts supply and it can take some time. And
70 million airbags, that's a huge number.
Sure, and there's one thing I'll add that is very frustrating, I think, for consumers is, there's no law or rule requiring free, you know, replacement cars to be given to you by a dealership. Automakers often will do that as a courtesy when you take your car in for a repair, but there's no requirement for that.
Well, I mean, that's what I've been thinking about, driving around with a Honda that's got a Takata airbag, and
right,
which, you know, I need, but really, I'm supposed to just be risking, you know, I don't know, my head while they get their act together?
Yeah, and it's a huge, you have to make a calculation, right? How risky is it, how risky is the airbag in your estimation, and experts' estimation? Will you get a replacement car? If you don't get a replacement car, how are you going to get to work? These are systemic issues that are really hurting everybody involved.
Gary in Abilene, Texas. Gary, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Love the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
My wife and I have been in numerous accidents, none of which were our fault, all of which totaled our vehicles. In 2006, after the last one, we decided to buy a Subaru from a dealer out of town.
Okay.
Fast forward to 2014, we get a recall notice for the passenger side airbag. We have some relatives living in a certain city nearby. I won't name any cities.
Okay.
We drove 3 hours to have the airbag replaced. We get to the dealer and find out that they've only done one or two. That's going to take them about 2.5 days. It's our only car.
Oh, no.
So we eat lunch with our relatives and drive back home, 3 hours back home.
Yeah.
Contact another dealer in another city. They never work with us. Contact the third dealer in another city that's 3 hours away. I emailed the service manager, got everything set up, I sent them the VIN and the mileage and
yeah,
all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Then the service manager changed. They never would correspond with me. They just dropped the ball entirely. Months later, I finally make an appointment to go see them. So this is a horrendous experience for us. I will never buy another car from a dealer out of town. I never expected something like this.
That sounds like a rough chain of events and numerous accidents, none your fault. Watch out on the road, Gary, and maybe get somewhere where there are, I don't know, more Subaru drivers than in Abilene. I'm not sure what's behind all that, but I appreciate your call. I mean, Sean, there are a lot of people out there who aren't getting the recalls taken care of. Maybe it's just a hassle. Maybe it's too far away. They're not doing it. A lot of these cars are on the road.
Well, you know, let's unpack that, Tom, because, we're hearing this narrative from the automakers when some tragedy occurs, they pull up their database and say, you know what, we sent out 3 notices to those folks. They just didn't come in and get it replaced. Well, first of all, are they actually getting the notices? There's a lot of times there's no evidence they are. The manufacturers are using outdated mailing lists. They're sending them by first class mail. They're doing a lousy job. In fact, when NHTSA did a recall seminar last year to talk about some of these issues, for the first time, major automakers were studying why people are having difficulty getting their cars in for recalls. I mean, we're in 2015 and they're finally starting to examine that. These are the same companies that can find you in a heartbeat when they need to sell you something.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so that's a real problem. And, when you're looking at the recall response, How do you correlate this when you get a recall notice in the mail that says this can kill you? It's a death or injury situation. You call up for an appointment, and guess what? They don't have the part, or they can't make it available. Okay, for some period of time that you don't even know. So now you've got this death or injury notice, and they're telling you, don't worry about it. You can drive your car.
Yeah.
What does that do? That diminishes the message of the importance of a recall, which by its very nature is in fact safety related, or it wouldn't be a recall.
I want to bring in Jason Vines from Wilmington, North Carolina, former communications chief for the Ford Motor Company, Chrysler Group, Nissan North America, during some of their big PR crises. Jason Vines, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think of the way the automakers are communicating about recalls? It feels like we're just in a recall waterfall here.
Well, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to have recalls. I'd rather have recalls and the vehicles get fixed than for automakers to hide defects and not get the vehicles.
What are their incentives, Jason? Is there incentive for people to actually come in and get the fix, or their incentive is to let you know but do it in such a way that you just keep driving because they don't want to pay out for the fix?
Well, the automakers want to fix the vehicles. I've said this in many lectures at universities. The automakers are greedy. They want you to buy a car. And then they want 2 years later for you to buy another car. And then 2 years later, buy another car. And then have your kids buy cars. They don't want to kill you. They have an incentive to get profitable by keep selling you cars.
Well, I don't think they could play the odds on that one. I mean, even with all this airbag trouble, it's only 11, I think it's 11 deaths, which is a lot if you're one of them, but it's not many out of the million cars sold.
Right, but, the death toll in these crises is any death is bad, but I was involved in the Ford Firestone tire crisis, which was considered the mother of all the crises, and 271 people died. But Ford Motor Company, who later fired me and the CEO, they spent every waking minute across the globe trying to find tires and trying to find the issue of what was happening to those tires. They put the customer first. What you're seeing lately in a couple of these crises is that the automaker is not putting the customer first. GM did not put the customer first in the ignition switch. Someone or someones found the defect, fixed it going forward, but not going backwards. And unfortunately, the cars that had the faulty ignition switch were cars typically driven by young people who happen to be our worst drivers, less experienced, and 124, 125 people died, not as many as in the Ford Firestone tire crisis, but in some respects a worse crisis because somebody knew and didn't do anything about it going backwards.
And here we sit. I mean, are we in a time of hypervigilance, or are the automakers just screwing up, Jason?
Well, you have so many components that go across so many car lines in order to save cost. And I heard an earlier comment, are they just trying to save a buck? Yeah, they are, because that keeps cars affordable. So you have an ignition switch, or you have a gas cap that you put on 7 million vehicles instead of 100,000 vehicles. And when you find that it's defective, you got to recall all of those products. So it doesn't scare me that millions of cars are being recalled. I'm glad they're being recalled and fixed. It scares me worse when companies are either being deceitful or cheating, much like in the Volkswagen incident. No one's going to die from the Volkswagen emissions scandal. However, that was woeful deceit on their part, woeful deceit, and it was system-wide. That is horrendous.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about this big auto recall moment, two record years for recalls back-to-back, and the fallout for you and the industry. Carfax estimates more than 47 million U.S. vehicles have at least one uncompleted recall. One in five vehicles, almost. That's up 27% over a year earlier. Those cars are just on the road. Many of them, if it's an airbag, 70 million airbags have to be replaced. It's going to take some time to get all that done. Is that you driving around with a recall unaddressed? Tom Costello joins us in just a moment. We're going to look at airport safety in this hour in the aftermath of Istanbul. Mike Spector is here from the Wall Street Journal. Sean Kane joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Jason Vines from Wilmington, North Carolina. He spent a lot of time in the automotive industry talking about their issues. Teresa in Detroit, thank you very much for calling, Teresa. You're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, I work in a customer service call center for a major automobile manufacturer in Detroit.
How's it going?
And, oh, we're busy. What I can tell you is that there's so many tentacles involved in recalls. You know, the manufacturer is mandated by the federal government for recalls. Something that, you know, people ask is, you know, they call in and they have a problem, and we'll see repeat concerns, calls coming in. People are calling, is there a recall about this? You should recall this. The federal government has to mandate the recall, so call the NHSTA if you're having a problem. That's what gets recalls started, not just calling into the manufacturer.
So you've got car owners who are calling in and saying they want a recall because they're having a problem on a part and they want a free fix?
Well, okay, dealerships are independently owned. Distributorships are independently owned. Recalls are done free of charge. There's also other types of, you know, programs that the manufacturers put out themselves that are not recalls that will repair things. But, a dealership is independently owned. So you're dealing with a small business owner, and they control their employees and they control their business. When they do a recall repair, they're getting paid by the manufacturer for that recall. So do they, I mean, yes, they are required to perform them. How willing are they to do it, and how easy are they going to make that for the consumer?
Is it working well, Teresa, or is it a mess, or what?
It depends, and that's why I have my job, because there are some dealerships that just do not. I mean, some of them, they just step right. A customer will call in, say, "Hey, I got this recall notice. What do I do?" You contact the dealership, either their purchasing dealership or their dealership in their area. They jump on it. They get it taken care of, because customer service, they know that is their bread and butter.
Teresa, let me pick that up right there. Sean Kane, what's the incentive here for dealers? Is it a profit center for them? All these recalls, they're happy to have you bring your car in, they'll fix it right up, or it's a pain in the neck somehow?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point, because it is, in fact, there's a conflict here. The manufacturers spend the money because they've got to reimburse their franchise dealers. But for the dealers, it's a business opportunity. And the little known and the dirty secret for this is that for auto dealers, recalls are good business. You bring your car in for a recall, and guess what? Oh, you've got some brakes that are low. You've got this. While you're in here, let's get that serviced. In fact, actively, many dealerships are going out and proactively notifying consumers of open recalls that they have on their vehicles. And I think that serves a good purpose if they're being straight up about it, but they're also doing it to improve their sales, again, which is fine. But they've got to do a good job, and they've got to make it convenient and easy. as I said before, you know, when someone has a car and they are have an open recall, it's not their defect. It's the manufacturer's defect. They need to apply the same tools to get that car remedied, whether that means going to their house, giving a rental car, getting it as easy as possible to get that that repair done, because recalls are all safety related by mandate.
You guys are great, and there's a lot more we'd like to know, but we've got to look at airport security in this hour as well, with the July 4th weekend coming up and the Istanbul attack just behind us, and I'm going to have to jump to do that. I'm so grateful to each of you for being with us today. Sean Kane at Safety Research and Strategies, thank you very much for joining us, Sean.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Jason Vines, former communications chief at Ford Motor Company. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Jason.
It's a pleasure.
And Mike Spector, automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Detroit. Mike, you're always great. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You bet.
If I may, let me turn right now to Tom Costello. He covers aviation for NBC News with Lester Holt. Tom Costello in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Hello. Nice to hear your voice.
It's good to have you right here, Tom. For just a moment here, take us to the Joint Andrews Base reports of an active shooter there this morning. Are those settled already? Was that a false alarm?
It does appear it was a false alarm. You know, there was a coincidence here, apparently, or utter confusion. They had a drill scheduled for today in which they would try to drill down in the event of an active shooter. This is all very real for the Washington area.
Yep.
Because, of course, just three years ago, we had an active shooter at the Navy Yard, 13 people killed. But somehow, during the drill this morning, there was utter confusion. Somebody called in, thought that there was a real drill. That, as a result, triggered a massive response, all local jurisdictions sending in their police units, their SWAT teams to assist. It now appears it was simply confusion over that drill set for earlier this morning.
But that looks like a real pins and needles mentality at work here in the aftermath of the Istanbul attack, perhaps. Tom, talk to us about how this Istanbul attack was such a high death toll and so many wounded. I mean, just terrible. How is that affecting the way American security authorities are thinking about U.S. airport security right now?
Well, there's always a constant reevaluation of U.S. airport security. And I don't mean that as a throwaway line. I mean, quite literally, they rethink security almost every week, and certainly in the wake of any overseas attack. And the one thing that we come away with the Istanbul attack is that there was something that worked for police. They had just instituted a new security directive in Istanbul at the airport in which they put police officers, heavily armed officers, at airport entrances. And as a result, those officers were able to intercept the terrorists as they were coming in and beginning their attack and stop it very early on. The death toll is still high, but it could have been so much worse.
I mean,
the question is, can that be then incorporated into the way we do airport security here?
I'm trying to picture how that would work. I've been flying a fair amount recently, and I just sashay right into the airport. There's no, and you know, at the door, there's nothing. I'm in.
Yeah, that's exactly the issue here in the United States. Listen, there's a big difference between how many people travel in the United States. 2 million people are screened every day, 450 airports. Versus a singular, really, the biggest and most important airport in Turkey is Istanbul. You've got a singular airport in Israel being Tel Aviv. They have 50,000 passengers a day. So those airports can afford to have their military dispersed, to have police tactical units working overtime. To do that at every airport in America is a huge challenge. One major airport police chief said to me today, we simply don't have the money. We don't have the manpower. I don't have the ability to keep a tactical police unit constantly up and running at all times, because obviously that's a drain on them as well.
Well, look,
the question is, is that a good deterrent to put that kind of an armed presence at major airport entrances? And if so, do airports need to consider staffing up?
I mean, speaking as a traveler, when I do travel, I would much prefer not to have to go through security at the door of the airport. I'd rather live in an environment where security is generally greater than that. And I guess so far, Tom, that's the case here in the States. I mean, we haven't had this kind of doorstep attack that they suffered in Istanbul.
Well, we haven't. And that's the fine line everybody walks. Yeah, you don't want to scare everybody. You don't want to hyperventilate over every overseas event. At the same time, we do have a new reality in the world that we live in. And the CIA director just on Thursday said, or rather Wednesday, said that he is very concerned that ISIS may be plotting something against U.S. assets in the United States and overseas. Now, could they launch something that big in the United States? Clearly, that's the concern for aviation professionals. And most importantly, they're concerned about the insider threat, somebody who already has access to an airport because they work here, they've got badges and what have you. and then they become radicalized. And it's not picked up by their colleagues. They don't have a criminal record that flags anybody. That's a very big concern for aviation security professionals, in addition to how well are these airports hardened or protected against a possible attack. And the short answer on that is not very well.
What lessons are people taking from Istanbul? There were three attackers there, I guess, showed up in a taxi cab in winter coats in the middle of summer. And they were initially, I guess, stopped at the door. What kind of screening are they doing at the door in Istanbul now, Tom?
Well, like I said, you've got these armed officers at the gate, at the door, rather, in Istanbul that immediately spotted something wasn't right. And at least one of those officers tried to confront one of the terrorists. And we know that all of these terrorists were stopped before they penetrated deep into the airport. You're absolutely right. Wearing a big coat, as any police officer will tell you anywhere in the world, you wear a big coat in the middle of the summer, that's an immediate red flag. But then there are other things that were flagging officers about these individuals, their demeanor. We now know they were apparently all native Russian speakers coming from various former Soviet republics. It would appear the early in reporting from Richard Engel, who is our correspondent based in Istanbul, is that they had some sort of a connection to ISIS cells either in Syria or through their own native regions.
I mean, ISIS is right next door to Turkey, and for a long time, Turkey let it flow right through their territory on the way to Syria and beyond. In the States, the attacks we've had with an ISIS association have all seemed to be lone wolf, not this kind of three guys, heavily armed, all bombed up, sort of ISIS orchestrated, if that's what it was.
Well, I mean, let's keep in mind, Brussels was a major coordinated attack involving multiple individuals, same thing in Paris. I think that there is no doubt this morning, today, whatever day you wake up this summer, this is the new reality in Europe and throughout the Middle East. Europe is clearly at war with ISIS, and now Turkey has joined the war on ISIS. It already had been allowing for more active campaigns against ISIS from its own territory. So the question today, I think, is whether you might see Turkish military forces become more actively engaged in the fight against ISIS over in Syria.
Let's go to Austin, Texas. Morgan is calling for you, Tom. Morgan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is about other airports that seemingly have fewer events, Israel's in particular, where there's also a smaller amount of armed forces present. And I wonder if there's anything we can learn from airports like these.
Tom Costello, what about airport security around the world and what the U.S. might learn or pick up or implement?
So that is exactly the focus of a Today Show story that I worked on just this week. And the difference in Israel is that they have 50,000 people coming through a day, more or less. And they do have a very heavy police tactical unit there at the airport. They've also got a military presence at the airport. And when you approach the airport, every single car is checked by that military or police unit. So you can't just drive up to the terminal. Everybody's checked. Once you're in the terminal in Tel Aviv, there is facial recognition software. There are undercover agents that are watching everybody, as well as the cameras. Then you have every single passenger questioned thoroughly. And not just passengers, but anybody in the airport can be randomly stopped and questioned. I've actually gone through that. I was going through Tel Aviv, and I was stopped by this drop-dead, gorgeous, blonde young woman who was wearing a uniform. And I was later told by a security expert that they do that on purpose. They use people who will kind of get you a little bit rattled because of whatever their presence may be.
Yep.
And they start questioning you. They ask you, what is your name? What is your date of birth? Where were you born? What is your address? Where are you going? And they stare you down in that airport to see if you demonstrate any signs that there may be something amiss. But they don't have nearly the passenger volume that we have in the United States. And to institute that kind of an approach in the United States would literally bring air travel to a halt.
I mean, Tom Costello, I don't want to – no one wants an attack in this country at an airport. On the other hand, I don't want to go crazy either. I like just walking into the airport and taking off. I want to be a free citizen in a free country and not worrying about all that all the time.
So that is exactly the challenge that airport security directors are facing every day. You know, in Europe, they don't go to that extreme that Tel Aviv does, but you do have two- and three-man military units patrolling airport terminals with heavy semi-automatic weapons. At a minimum, that's a deterrent. It also helps people feel better. But if you've got more and more of those units deployed to airports, which we all know are high-value targets in Europe, then might that be enough of a deterrent that terrorists will decide to go elsewhere? That's the problem, though. Ultimately, if they want to strike, they're going to go somewhere.
You say they're constantly reevaluating, even week to week, based on trends and what they're seeing as threats. What kinds of changes do you foresee in the near term here, Tom, or can you even imagine in U.S. airports? We've become accustomed to the security line and the X-ray or the whatever the other thing is that whirls around while you stand in it. Is that it for the time being?
I think for the time being, that probably is it, unless, God forbid, we really do have an attack here. But if you talk to security experts about what's on the horizon, they will tell you ultimately what they hope to have in place would be cameras with software that are constantly scanning the crowd and trying to match faces against the terror watch list. That is years off, candidly. Also technology that would be constantly scanning people looking for weapons underneath their coats before you get to the checkpoint, for example. They want to have that kind of software in position in place even before you approach the terminal out on the curb. If you talk to airport police unions, we talked to the police union at LAX, they believe that they need more armed officers. They want to restrict the access points into the airport. And the TSA will tell you that is one of their major concerns and frustrations, has been that many airports, and by the way, local jurisdictions control their access to their own airport.
Sure.
That they don't control enough access points, that they don't restrict them enough. Now, Miami's an exception. They have a very tight security blanket on their airport. Orlando, Atlanta has done the same thing following a big scandal there with gun running.
Okay.
But most airports in the country, are, according to the TSA, could do a lot better job in really securing and limiting their access points.
Tom Costello, we're headed right into a big holiday weekend, 4th of July. Briefly, should people expect to see something different here, or are we pretty much steady as she goes right now?
I think if you're in a big city, if you're in Atlanta, if you're in New York, if you're in Miami, you might see that police tactical unit out. Don't think anything of that. That's kind of a normal deployment. They're just trying to raise the high-profile nature of that unit. Beyond that, in most cities across the country, it's going to be business as usual.
Tom Costello with NBC News with Lester Holt. Tom, you're terrific. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Listeners, you can join the conversation always and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook there at On Point Radio. Be first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests, go to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for being with us. This is On Point.